very much for the lovely introduction. Yes, I did ride Harley Davidson's, our wonderful motorbike, and very good for the ego as well. So I did have to let go of those before I became a monk, but I can speak Harley Davidson language, so when guys come to the monastery and girls on motorbikes, I can speak motorbike language. It's very handy because meditators are sometimes motorcycle riders as well. Have we got any motorcycle riders here? Yep. Audience? Wow. Oh. Yeah. Nice.
Bob.
Yeah. And
female too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. My ex-girlfriend rode a Norton Commando. I think it was, are they 750 or 850? Commando. Very nice motorcycle. Could she? She couldn't. But she could sometimes. But she had trouble starting it. Yeah. Don't. They are a bit tricky. You need to get your full weight kind of behind it, the kickstart. Thank you for having me along. Yes. Oh, we start with the chanting. Yeah. Is there a spare one? I kind of know it off by heart, and if I start going sideways, someone chant louder than me. But and I think two of our sentences are a little bit different. Yeah. Oh no, thanks, Matt. Yeah, I'll try and wing it. Try and wing it. So yeah, we'll start with the chanting of the Metta Sutta, and it's a wonderful sutta. It's my favourite sutta. In Pali, my name is in it. That's why I know this sutta. The bit where it talks about soft and gentle in speech, mudu anati mani. So that's what Ajahn gave me the name. So I really like that sutta. It's a good all rounder. Even if you're not Buddhist, you just come for the meditation. This one gives you a bit of a taste of Buddhism, because it's kind of sums up what the Buddha was all about in one nice kind of sutta. Okay, here we go. Do we start with the namo tassa? No, we just go straight into it.
This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world. fading upwards through the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, freed from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be that's alive, abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. The famous Ajahn Brahm, three sadhus. There is two spots in that the words differ slightly than what we chant at the monastery, and I couldn't remember where they were, so I just blurted out what I knew. What a lovely sutta. Metta is a wonderful thing. And I remember Ajahn Brahm talking about metta. It was how I first came across it. They said, oh, you can do metta practice. And there's like some of our monks even teach metta meditation. So that is a kind of meditation. I kind of don't really have a fixed kind of meditation technique. Step 1, 2, 3, and 4. I roll them all into one. I sit down, I shut up, and just watch what goes on in my mind. And that's very easy. But when I do guided meditation, I do a little bit more explaining than that, because that would just be too easy a job for me. Sit down and shut up and watch what's going on in your mind. But at the end of the day, that's what we are doing. Kind of, and that's what Ajahn Brahm teaches all the monks at the monastery. I choose the easy path, which is listen to my teacher. It certainly makes sense to me what he does. He keeps everything very simple. I used to think, you know, it's a bit too simple. I need steps. I need to complicate it a bit more. With A, step B, part 1, 2, and 3. But I find that I had two different types of meditation. When I first started meditation as a layperson, I'd come to groups like this. I'd go to Nolamara on a Friday night. Meditation was quite easy because Ajahn Brahm would lead it, and all I had to do was follow along. There was all these people I was meditating with. I feel wonderful because there was all these like-minded people coming to practice peace, which was different than in the other parts of my life, in the workplace, where it was not practicing peace. It was quite often practicing stress, and sometimes with a bit of anger thrown in for good measure. And I come along to a place like this, and everyone was wanting the same thing. They wanted some peace, they wanted friendliness, they wanted kindness. And I found those meditations quite easy. And I would go on a Friday night and do the guided meditation, and then I'd go back home and practice, and it was never the same. It was always a lot harder. I'd nod off, I'd fall asleep. I couldn't work out why it was different, but and I suppose there's a myriad of reasons why it is different. But I'd go back again next Friday and have another wonderful meditation, and kind of wondering why it was different. The same thing happened when I became a monk, or became an Anagarika. Did the training in white for a year, then did the year as a novice, where you wear the robe, but you're a novice monk, you're not a fully ordained monk. And you can't tell the difference because we wear the same robes. And And then after 2 years of that training, you can get the higher ordination, become a fully ordained monk. But the meditation doesn't seem to... The same sorts of things happen, you know. Because I'm at the monastery and I'm not going to guided meditations, I'm kind of on my own. And Ajahn Brahm doesn't do guided meditations at the monastery. You're pretty much on your own. There's the Wednesday night talk he does every Wednesday night, which isn't a guided meditation, it's a talk. Ajahn Brahm gives an inspiring talk to keep everyone dialed in and happy to be there. So a few little tips. It feels like he's talking to you. It's like, gee, they're exactly the things I needed to hear about my meditation. All these things about the wandering mind and frustration and sleepiness in your meditation. But really, you think he's talking to you, and you know, quite possibly he is, because he's quite a good meditator. But they are common problems that kind of everyone has. And as a monk now of so I'm about to start my 6 reigns and 2 training years on that, so 8 years at the monastery of practicing. And so a lot of the same problems that I had as a layperson are still there. And I don't get frustrated anymore. It's just like, oh, I am just so happy to be a monk at Bodhinyana Monastery with all this wonderful support, that when these other problems come up, and Ajahn Brahm's, you know, basically what he says is you just make peace with these uncomfortable things in your meditation, whether it be sleepiness in your meditation or kind of agitation. Agitation is always kind of something that even Ajahn Brahm, it's great when you hear him say that he gets these things as well, because then it puts you on the same page. And that's really helpful, because he often, or not often, every now and then he'll give some examples of his frustrations in his meditation, and it's so helpful because you feel like you're on the same page, and then you know it's just a normal thing. And what he always says is, I'm not, so like if he gets... I remember him saying 1 year that the meditation always starts off with some discomfort. It feels a bit uncomfortable. Like you sit down, ready to meditate, cross your legs, close your eyes, and you feel a bit fidgety, you know? You kind of go, well, I've actually got a few other jobs I'd rather do. And then kind of, you have this kind of feeling of wanting to go and do those instead. But it's almost a little bit like being unkind when you kind of, because you're pushing your meditation away and you're saying, I'd rather do something else. And if you look at that a little closer, what you're actually doing is you're being unkind to your meditation. This is something where if you look closely, you'll be able to see that. It's, I'd rather do something else than hang out with you, meditation. I'd rather do something else than hang out with my mind, which is, you can kind of look at meditation like that. I look at it like that, where I'm hanging out with myself when I meditate. I'm hanging out with my mind, and what I need to do is be good mates with it. It needs to be a good friend. Ultimately, if you can kind of work with it, and I've had a lot of practice doing this, I am good mates with my mind. I'm good friends with it. I like to hang out with it. And that's the mindset I go into the meditation with, and it's it might be easy for me to say this, and because I've been practicing for a while, and it does take a little bit of practicing being a mate with your own mind, but that is what you've got to do. So you have this initial agitation, for instance, and what I found is, and this is exactly what Ajahn Brahm said, the same thing, is that you make peace with this agitation. It could be fidgety muscles. It's usually fidgety mind accompanied with fidgety muscles, and uncomfort, and you can't get in the right spot. You move this leg, you move that leg, until you get comfortable. You can't get comfortable. But I don't really even do much fidgeting now. I just sit there with this mind that's a bit fidgety, and after a very short period of time, it settles down. And I just give my mind a big hug to start with. It's all right, mind. If you want to be fidgety, that's fine. We're here to hang out together and do what you do with your good mates. I've got some good mates at the monastery, and I've got good mates that visit me at the monastery. And what do I do when they come to the monastery? I make coffee for them, because I'm a coffee nut. I like to make coffee, so I have grind up some fresh beans, and I tell them a little story about where the beans came from and who roasted them, and I make a nice coffee for my friends. Well, I do the same with my mind, even though it's caffeinated. get used to having that kind of mindset, so it's not too bad. And I just make friends with the mind, happy to be there. I'm happy to meditate. It's not a chore. And I was talking to Matt about this on the way down, and the first few years being at the monastery is kind of like meditation. You do so much of it, it becomes a little bit of a chore. So you've got to really, you're backed into a corner. It's like, what am I supposed to do? I've got to meditate. I'm here as a monk. So you do learn to listen to Ajahn Brahm. I've very rarely tried other things. I only, he'd done all this before. So I just use the examples he said. And so I hang out with my mind, and I just make friends with it. And one of the catchphrases or mantras, I wouldn't call it a mantra, but Ajahn Brahm says you can use it as a mantra, is, and you've probably heard it before, make peace, be kind, and be gentle with every moment that comes up in your mind. And that's what I've done with my practice, and that's how the best and the quickest and the easiest way to be good friends with your mind, hang out with it, and that's what I did. I had an incident once as a layman on a 9-day retreat. I was in the Jhana Grove Meditation Retreat Center, and I was listening to Ajahn Brahm's instruction about being kind to yourself and rest as much as you want, take another serve of dessert, and just be really kind. So I tried these things, and it was all going well until I tried the have a rest in the afternoon thing. And it took me a while, because I've never done this in my life before. It was always something, you're not supposed to rest during the day, that's a waste of time. But I was on retreat, and I was listening to what Ajahn Brahm said, so I gave it a crack. I'm having a little rest in the afternoon. It took me a while to get to sleep, because I was feeling a bit guilty, it didn't feel right, but I was giving it a try. And I managed to nod off, and I woke up sometime later. I must have had half an hour of rest or something. I woke up, and I've never had one of these panic attacks before, but I think I might have had a panic attack. I woke up and my heart was racing, I was sweating, and I felt really guilty that I was having a rest and a sleep. Well, I thought, everyone must be up in the hall meditating, and I'm here slacking off having a sleep. And I'd totally forgotten the instructions that Ajahn Brahm had given, and I was just stressing out, and my heart was almost jumping out of my skin. I was beating that hard. I was in a lot of discomfort. So I went into fight or flight. Is that it? Fight or flight syndrome. I went into that. The adrenaline kicked in. I just ran up to the meditation hall in a flap and a fluff. And people were sitting there all quiet meditating. And I felt like my heart was just so loud that everyone could hear it. And I sat down and I chanted this mantra, make peace, be kind, be gentle. I was saying it so loud in my brain, I thought that everyone could hear it coming out of my head, the silence. And I had to say it over and over, I think for about half an hour. I was really suffering big time. But eventually I settled down, my heart settled down, and I got still, and then after another half an hour, so I was meditating for about an hour, I got into the stage of meditation that I'm sure a lot of you have heard been explained, called the beautiful breath, the delightful breath. It is, I would call it a signpost in meditation. If this comes up in your meditation, and it comes up in various stages, it's kind of a little bit subtle at the start, but if you're mindful enough and you do see it, there's something to really value, because the beautiful breath is a tipping point, it's a gateway to like deeper meditations, and it's more than that, it is a kind of a deep meditation of its own, in its own right. This beautiful breath is, it's where peace comes up. The breath becomes very light. If you don't know about what the beautiful breath is or the delightful breath, something to look out for in your meditation. It's different than a normal breath. A normal breath that we're breathing now, or if you were to stop and pay attention to your breath and observe its texture, its feeling, how it, whether it's coarse or light, you'll notice that the breath is when it's compared with the delightful breath, it's much coarser. The beautiful breath has, or the delightful breath has, a silky quality to it. It's soft and it's very smooth. And it's sometimes, why it has that sensation is because, and I've heard Ajahn Brahm also say this, and I'd agree, is that it's because the other five senses are starting to become much more calmer, because when we meditate, we're kind of looking to go into the mind rather than in the body. We start off with the body, but we eventually go into the mind. And the breath becomes sensed through the mind. That's why it feels different. That's why it feels lighter, because you're not feeling it with the sense of touch anymore, and the sense of sound so much, although the sense of sound hearing is still there. The way you sense the breath is largely in the mind. That's why it feels different. That's why it feels lighter. And even to the extent that the sensation of the breath, you don't know where it is, because when you breathe, there's all these different parts of the body that do the breathing. You have your diaphragm, which goes in and out, which is below your, it's in your abdomen, that rises and falls and draw and makes the lungs kind of expand or contract and draws air in. And so you normally sense that movement, and sense the hairs in the throat and the membranes of the throat and the nose and the trachea. They all have a touch sensation to them. So that is how you normally sense the breath. But when all those touch sensations start to become subdued as you get into your meditation, like I said, the feeling of the breath is sensed in the mind more so. And that's why you know that your meditation is going in the right direction. It's a really good signpost if you do have that come up. If it doesn't come up, that's fine as well, but if it does, then it's like, yes, beautiful breath. And whenever I get to that stage of meditation, I don't ask for anything else. I shouldn't ask. You don't ask for anything anyway in your meditation. You just sit back and get out of the way, and the meditation happens by itself. The moment you start asking for more stuff or looking for more stuff, that's when you get in the way of your meditation. So if the beautiful breath comes up, it's like Satu, beautiful. It has a lovely texture to it, and it is accompanied with peace and a little bit of bliss. That's some of the signposts of the beautiful breath. So when that sensation of peace comes up, and everyone may sense that differently, that's one of the beautiful breath comes with peace, and it comes with a little bit of bliss. Ajahn Brahm talks about the huge amounts of bliss, but quite often it's also little pieces of bliss, just a little tiny bit of a good feeling associated with it. So they're some of the key signposts that are good to look out for with the beautiful breath. And just before we go in to start the meditation, just a few more minutes, just like to say how that's something that is good to be mindful of when you're doing your meditation. Just kind of don't kind of go looking for the breath too hard, like when you kind of lose something in your bag and you're digging around for it. I've lost my wallet, and that you just, the breath usually, like when you get used to it, it comes to you. You don't need to go to it and look for it. It just comes to you. It's all of a sudden there's this peace will come over you, and then it's just like, oh, there's the breath. It goes in and out, but it has a different texture, so it's something kind of, there's something a little bit exciting about it. And that sometimes the first time you get the beautiful breath, it has so much excitement with it that you get excited, and then you kind of lose your meditation a little bit because you get over excited by it. But that's okay. You get a taste for it, and then next time, and you can get back to it as well. You just kind of take a couple of steps back and just go, okay, mudu, get out of the way, let the breath do what it does by itself. Yeah, so sometimes it just comes up by itself. It's accompanied by a peace, and that peace is like no other peace. Well, it is similar to some other pieces you may have in your life, but those moments of peace are so rare that I believe that meditation peace that you get is very hard to kind of find that anywhere else. Yeah, sure, there's some lovely scenery, ocean, forest. You can sit down there in the quiet, and maybe you're in a meditative state anyway because you're in this lovely place, and you will get that kind of peaceful feeling come up. But it's something that I would be looking out for in the meditation if it comes up, and value it when it comes up, because it's such a rare thing, this peace. And when these moments of peace can be sustained by just not getting too excited and just watching this breath in and out, and this is where the whole breath meditation comes from, just watching this beautiful breath, watching it all the way to enlightenment, like the Buddha did. And quite often, you might lose your breath after a bit because you get a little bit bored with it, and another thought comes up, and that's fine. You just kind of acknowledge that thought coming in and just kind of go with the flow. That's the thought that comes in. It's your own mind doing that. There's no point getting upset with it. Just kind of, it's your mind doing what it does. Okay, so that's just some really kind of good things to look out for in your meditation, the beautiful breath. And we'll get ready for the meditation now. Okie dokie. Alright. So we'll do some meditation now. So the first thing we do with meditation is we get comfortable and we get ready for position we can sit down for the next 20 to 30 minutes. And the Buddha talked about four postures: standing, walking, sitting, lying down. They were in the Metta Sutta we just chanted. They're all appropriate postures. So the best ones for us here are sitting, because we don't have the space for walking. Sitting on a chair is also fine. Sitting on the floor is fine. I like to sit on the floor, but I have many, many cushions. I must have has 3, 4, 5, 6 cushions. When I sit on the floor, get myself really comfortable. That's part of being kind to myself, being kind to the body. And we'll do a way I start the meditation as well is with a quick body sweep meditation, just so we can be kind to the body and prepare it for the meditation where we go into the mind. We've got that 5 senses: taste, touch, smell, sight, sound. And what we're trying to do is relax those senses so we can go to the 6th sense. Sense number 6, the mind. That's where the meditation happens proper. But we can move our meditation through the other senses slowly. So we start by closing our eyes. And that sense at the door is closed because we've closed our eyes. There's no visual stimuli or visual cues coming in because we've closed our eyes. Sense of sound is usually the last sense to become relaxed. So we just allow that to be. We don't have the privilege of eyelids, like eyelids. We can't close our ears off to sound. Even putting our fingers in our ears or earplugs, the sound still gets through. So that's one sense door. We just make peace with it. And any noises that come in, we just make peace with those noises. Be kind to them and be gentle. Sense of smell and taste largely they're relaxed because they're quite active when we eat or drinking, and we're not doing that now, so those senses we don't need to worry about. When we're left then with a sense of touch, and that's where we do the quick body sweep meditation, running through the parts of the body, making peace, being kind, being gentle with them. And by doing that, we're preparing our mind. Our mind is already set up. That kindness will just flow straight from the body into the mind. Body sweep meditation with the feet, and we just send some basic kind sense, a thought, contact to our feet. Thank you, feet, for carrying me here today. Some people are in wheelchairs, or they're in bed, they're sick, they can't walk. We were very lucky enough to be able to walk here today. So for myself, I've been blessed to be able to walk all 49 years of my life, and I can say thank you to my feet for bringing me here today to be with this wonderful group of like-minded people and sharing this meditation. Thank you, feet. Move that contact, that sense up through the feet into the bones and the muscles of the heel and the ankles. It also allows us to walk here up through the calf muscles, sending kindness. You can call it metta. Metta is very similar kind of concept of kindness, loving kindness, sending that loving kindness up into the knees. Thank you, knees, for articulating my walking thousands, hundreds of thousands of times in my 49 years without too much problem. Thank you, knees. Moving that kindness, how to visualize that kindness. Now, some people visualize the kindness or the loving kindness of metta as a glowing color, golden glowing ball of light. You can even add that in, you just kind of make it up as you go along. But the idea is to send this kindness up through the body and to relax it as much as you can, so that the sense of touch has its can be relaxed. And that sense contact, we move up the legs into the hips, sending kindness. Thank you, hips, giving me a trouble-free movement all these 49 years of my life. Thank you, hips. Even the people that have had hip replacements, we've just been kind to our body, give it a bit of a service and a tweak here and there, just like replacing a part in a car. You do that because you want to be kind to your car. It's like being kind to your body. These replacement hips, what a wonderful, wonderful invention. And then we can move that kind thought up into the stomach, into our tummies, which do a marvelous job most of the time digesting all that food without fault, without problem, and supplying the body with the energy it needs initially to grow when we're younger, and now supplying us with the energy to live every day of our life. My meals are supplied by very kind and generous donors, so now that thought comes to my mind as well, and it's just generating happiness all the way along, from my toes to my stomach. It's just a sense of happiness, a sense of happiness that comes with that kindness. It's automatic. The two seem to kind of go hand in hand. I'm privileged to have that meal given by kind donors every day. So any way that you can pick up a free bit of happiness along the way in your meditation, take it and run with it. This is what fuels this meditation, is happiness. So I'm just picking it up as I'm going along the tummy. I'm sending it kindness, and then I think about the kind people that donated that food and so on and so on. Then I move that kindness up into the diaphragm, the breath. And this is something also to be, for me, it's something to generate a lot of joy and happiness, because that's where my meditation happens. It happens quite often in the breath. And that's what took the Buddha all the way to enlightenment. Same thing. So yeah, thinking about the breath brings me a lot of joy and happiness. And my breath, what other thing can I think of that can be a greater friend of mine than the breath? I took my first breath when I came out of my mum's tummy, and this breath will be with me to the day I die. Why not be good friends with the breath? Thank you, breath, for being with me. Just observing a couple of breaths while I'm there. Thank you, breath. deep breath. I'll see you later on in the meditation. Be back. And we move that kindness up into the shoulders, down the arms, elbows, to the hands, fingers, all the little muscles and bones there. Finally, we move the attention up into the neck muscles, sending them kindness. I had a bit of a bad sleep at Nolamara the other day for New Year's, and I'm cricking my neck, so I just give it a bit of a wobble. Send it as much kindness as I can. It's almost better now. Working on it for the last week, and then move that kind metta thought up into the head, the face muscles, and wherever the mind might be. It's a bit hard to put the finger on where the mind is, but maybe it's somewhere, you might want to imagine it somewhere in your brain, in your head somewhere, just sending the kindness there. The body is as relaxed as it can be. We can very gently, very kindly, softly as we can, move our kindness and our mindfulness and our attention onto the mind. This is where the meditation happens now. We've made our body as comfortable as it can be. Now we're moving that kindness which we've been generating for the last 5 or so minutes into the mind, bringing that kindness with us. And what do? Now we're with the mind, we just simply hang out with it. Whatever comes up in our mind, we make peace with it. We be kind to it, and we're gentle. For most people who have never meditated before, this is something they have never done. Essential. We need to hang out with our minds. If you want a healthy mind, you must meditate. Just like if you want a healthy body, you eat well and you exercise it. If you want a healthy mind, you meditate and you hang out with your mind. Be kind to it. Thoughts come in, we allow them to be. try not to get into a conversation with those thoughts. Try not to lead one thought onto another, but just acknowledge that there's a thought there and allow it to pass by itself. Watching all the time what's going on in the mind with kindfulness. It's a mix of kindness and mindfulness. Sometimes the thoughts kind of calm down, and for me, sometimes the shapes come up, just lights. Patterns of light, swirls and different shapes. Quite pleasant. This quite often happens before the breath settles down. So just being observant, watching whatever comes up in the mind with kindness, and not getting involved with it. Just watching it from a distance, like it's a movie screen or a TV screen. If it's a feeling that comes up, again, just observe that feeling. Be kind to it. This is like hanging out with your best friends. Be kind to them. Allow them to be how they would like to be. The mind becomes more relaxed, you may notice the sensation of the breath rising and falling, just be happy to be with the breath. Just observing it, noticing the texture. Does it have a peaceful quality to it? Is it smooth? Notice the texture. And if the breath doesn't appear in your field of vision, then that's okay. You can just gently nudge your awareness onto the breath. And just remember those signposts. Beautiful breath, soft, gentle, light, accompanied by peace, and a pleasurable sensation. The last 5 or so minutes, I'm going to remain silent, and at the end of the meditation, I'll ring the gong 3 times. starting to get close to the end of the meditation. It's a good point to have a look at your peaceometer, just like a speedometer on your vehicle. This one will measure your peace and compare it to where you were at the start of the meditation, with the one being very peaceful and a 10 being very agitated. Now I'm going to ring the gong 3 times. Please wait until the last ring of the 3rd gong before you come out of meditation. I do like the idea of meditation being described, the purpose of it. I like the question that was once asked of Ajahn Chah, some professor from a university in America visited Ajahn Chah during the time when Ajahn Brahm was there, and asked Ajahn Chah why the meditation was important. What was all the hoo-ha about? Because all of these Westerners had kind of descended upon this little village in Thailand to become monks. This was just hadn't happened in Western culture before. It was quite a spectacle. It was quite a point of interest. So this big university, Stanford or some big university in America, they went there and asked Ajahn Chah, why do you meditate? What's all this about? And the best, he gave a really good answer that I've always kind of felt is the best answer I've ever heard for why we meditate. And he said to this professor, well, if you want a healthy body, you must eat well and exercise it. And I think that is so true. One of the ways I have scientifically tested this, and they say Buddhism can be scientifically tested because you can set up a test, you can set up an experiment, you can put a hypothesis in place, and you can create a methodology and a procedure and put all this stuff into place and then conduct the experiment and work out if it's true. Well, one of the tests I've done is I get so busy sometimes with my at the monastery. You might have heard that I've been involved with trying to deal with the surplus monks we have. We have a program how to get rid of surplus monks at Bodhinyana, and we've got a few, and the current waiting list is up to 5 years to become an Anagarika. So people are waiting all around the world to come and be taught by Ajahn Brahm. He's not getting any younger, and there's no places. So they said, Venerable Mudu, go and find somewhere else to practice. Or I actually said it to all the monks, particularly ones that had kind of had a few reins under their belt. At that time I only had 3 reins under my belt, or 4. And I'd already started teaching in Albany. I had an invitation from my brother. He said, why don't you come down there and teach? He said, come down and visit my family. He said, if you need an excuse to come down here, I know the Thai people, and I know that you've got to do these house blessings and restaurant dhanas and talks and meditation, so I'll organise a talk. And once he told these Thai people, the Thai community, that his brother was a monk, they were like, wow, you can get a monk down here? And like, monks in Albany were rare. There's like none. So they formally asked Ajahn Brahm if I could go down there, made a formal invitation, and Ajahn said, fine, you can go down there. While you're down there, go and teach at the prison and do a public talk. So I did that, and 2 years later, I'm still going. I'm doing 2 prisons and I think 5 public talks, and house dhanas every day while I'm there. It's really, really busy, well received, and almost from the get-go, they were saying, when can we have a monastery here? Can we have something down here for us, down here, Venerable Mudu? And I kind of, you know, kept it to myself for a while, because Ajahn Brahm was watching from a distance. This young Venerable Mudu only had 3 reins under his belt. Kind of, the first time I came back, he said, thank you for teaching down there. And that was it. That was just my pat on the back. That's all I got. And after that, every 3 months I went down, and he never said anything. Oh, where's my pat on the back? Nothing. So I'm looking for this praise. At least I wasn't getting blame. So the praise wasn't it, but that was fine. But after a while, and what I could see was Ajahn Brahm was actually watching from a distance, making sure that, you know, I could do the teaching down there, and making sure the feedback he was getting was okay. And I don't think I'm not sure what feedback he got. Whatever he got, it was clandestine. I didn't see what was going on. But I think the main thing was that he could see that the invitations were coming every 3 months, so it continued. And in the end, he got wind that the property was for sale there, and that I was staying at. I had an invitation from one of the members of the BSWA. She said, oh, I've heard you're teaching down there. I've got a property, you can stay on it while you're teaching. So I did that. I was really surprised when I found out the property was 160 acres of bush on the beach. And I used to be a surfer, so I was like looking for my surfboard, going to crack a few waves, which is totally not really allowed, I think, for monks. But I've been to watch my brother surf. He surfs at a spot down there. It's near a big surf beach, actually, this property. It's near Mutton Bird Beach. Anyone knows Albany? And so I kind of, 2 years went by. Ajahn heard the property was for sale. The owner, a member of the BSWA, kind of getting closer to retirement age, she was telling me for some visits that she was looking at selling the property, and I didn't want to kind of jump up and down in front of Ajahn Brahm. This property is for sale, we should build a monastery. I just waited, and I waited until he asked. And he asked, and he said, Mudu, is that property for sale that you stay at? I heard it's for sale. Is that true? I said, yes, it is. And before he could ask his next question, I said, do you want to build a monastery there? He said, yes, I do. And then I said, can I be the boss? And he said, yes. And I said, is that a good idea? He said, no. Shook his head and laughed. He thought, you're in for some fun and games there, Mudu. But he said, yes, I could be the boss. And he understands, because he's in that job. It is stressful and that, but I think he's willing for me to give it a go. So that's where everything started. I was already doing all of the engineering planning for the monastery, for all of our new huts and stuff like that. So I had Ajahn knew I could do that, so I started preparing the plans for this monastery. And this is where I'm getting back to this methodology of testing and Buddhism being scientific, because I started putting a lot of hours into engineering drawings. And my meditation practice dropped off a bit. And guess what happened? My mind didn't get healthy. It became unhealthy. Not in a super bad way, but I noticed I became more grumpy. I was shorter tempered with my fellow monks, my mates. And that's when I realized, you know, that was true what Ajahn Chah said. You know, if you want a healthy mind, you must meditate. So I discovered that from that test. For that test, I didn't plan it. It just happened by accident. Just spending a lot of hours kind of doing engineering planning. But that's actually kind of working out good, the Albany project. And I did bring along some literature, which I will leave here for people to have a look at. But what I will do at the end, or towards the end, is so this is the brochure that we did up. It's got Ajahn Brahm on the picture on the front, because he's our brand, I suppose, isn't he? So that there's
Ajahn Brahm's a brand?
I think that's, if you're one of these sales kind of marketing... Yeah. He's a big cuddly bear, he's like a mascot. But if you can pass them around, because I didn't bring hundreds, and I could have brought hundreds, but I forgot, and they were the only ones I could grab, so pass them around, and next week I'll send more up. But what I've done in Albany is, and all of the people that visit the monastery, I've asked them for their support, just by being able to contact them by email to let them know what's going on. And that is things like, oh, we bought this property, or this is happening, we've got a big event down there. And you just don't know, like, people here know people in Albany, or they've met someone from Albany, or their family there, and then you can say that. So what I might do is, if you don't mind, you don't have to, and it will be confidential, because it will be in my possession, your name, email, phone number, I can keep you up to date with what's happening. And that always includes a video on the bottom, which I took of, I used a drone. We went up, because we've got a drone for engineering stuff. I took that up in the sky, and I took video footage of the property and its proximity to the beach. So it's near the wind farms and all those big 120 meter high cliffs. It is absolutely beautiful. It's all forest. There's 500 meters of state forest between us and the beach. Yes.
Venerable, you're not sweeping in that picture.
I don't know, which picture is it?
Come on, the bottom.
Oh,
you're on the beach.
Yeah, I'm down on the beach. Yeah,
you're
that
not
one's
sweeping.
No sweeping there. It's too much sand. It's all beach sand. That one was taken at Middleton Beach, because I used to be a surf lifesaver, and that's where actually I got a lot of my fuel for my meditation fuel tank. I did a lot of service for Surf Life Saving Australia. I was a volunteer surf lifesaver, so when I go down to Albany, I like to go and visit the Albany Surf Life Saving Club. Just let those guys know, and girls, because there's a lot of girls there. I was actually involved in a women's surf boat crew. Anyone here done surf life saving? No. Oh, yeah. Did you surf boat rowing?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which club?
Bunbury.
Bunno.
Cool. Sweet boy, yeah.
Yes, I did. I was a sweep for a women's surf crew. Sweep is the it's kind of like the captain, stands at the back and yells orders at the rowers. Not really. I could never yell orders at the rowers, but some of those guys really do. They're really mean and tough. But so I go down there and just kind of try and give something back to those guys, just by kind of giving them, having a chat with them, telling them what a good job they're doing. They're basically, those people that do that job have a natural kind of happiness. because of what they give to the community. They don't realise it. They don't realise, oh, I'm going to get happy if I do this, so therefore I'm going to be a set of lifesaver. They do that job and they go home very happy every day. Bunbury, remember Bunbury, there's a shore break there. Shore break in Bunbury, like Sorrento or something like that. Remember, that was the club I started with, Sorrento, then I moved to Secret Harbour, which had a nice break. Can I please pass it around?
You've already got one.
No, yes, I've got Doug's.
You've already got mine,
No, I know, I should let you speak. He's already got
mine. Yeah,
you've got yours.
The coordinator here, Marley. She sends emails now to hundreds of people.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that would be helpful as well.
You'll get an email.
Yeah.
You've got to get their permission.
Okay.
You're only going to get 25%.
So I'll get what I've got tonight, and then I'll know because I can see the faces. And I kind of have some idea. I have to guess the name to the face. But you know, the more times you come, the more kind of faces and people you get to know anyway. And I will make that request for Marlene as well. So if she can forward them on.
We're allowed to do that.
That's correct. Yeah, that's why I prefer just actually I ask here. And then I know that these are legit ones, and then it's up to Marlene to send them out. Same with the BSWA. The secretary there sends them on my behalf, and I don't actually know those email addresses, so yeah. Although it's probably a good idea, it's probably because I haven't got their consent.
Or she could put an attachment.
Mm. Yeah, she could do it on.
She could ask.
She could put a
Yeah, that would be good. Yeah, so Albany Project is looking really good. There's a lot of support down there, and there's very close now to making a purchase. Yes.
How's your access road?
That is one of the problems we've had with this property. It doesn't have any access. It's kind of landlocked. We have this little road called a right of way, and that one gets you onto the property through another person's property, but we don't own that. So when you build a place like a monastery, it becomes, well, I think, like they call it a place of public worship, and there's a lot of rules that go with that when it comes to having the interests of the people that come there at stake. So if there's a bushfire, you need to make sure there's a bushfire management plan, and the bushfire management plan always requires of this sort of nature two access roads. So if one's on fire, the other one can be access. So I asked all the neighbours. Yes.
Just go to the beach, man.
Exactly. Yeah. The problem is you've got to jump off the cliff. The cliffs are 120 metres high, and it's a crunchy. Crunchy ending.
Yes.
And what's left of you, the white pointers will finish you off.
Hang gliders.
Yeah, we could set up some hang gliders.
Parachute.
There's a helipad there that's currently at the Bibbulmun campsite for Mutton Bird campsite. The Bibbulmun track has a helipad there, so yeah, we can actually utilise that. But all of the neighbours in front of us, we ask them all, even one of them is comes to a meditation group, and even she was a bit reluctant to sell some of her land. They're concerned about how many cars. Everyone asks how many cars are going to come up and down every day for dana, the people bringing the meals to the monks. So that's fair enough. These people have moved out to this Elika property area because it's peaceful, it's bush, it's quiet, and they don't want noisy Buddhists coming along. That's what they don't seem to understand, is actually we don't make any noise at all. But there will be this regular cars every day, but not many. You know, I'd say between 0 and 2 cars a day on the weekends, maybe up to 5. That might grow over the years as the place becomes more popular. But so and when I get your emails, I'll send you out a funny story. One of the people you've seen it, yeah. One of the this old English couple were. I didn't have time to send them a letter saying, "Oh, my name's Venerable Muda. We're looking at building a monastery. We're going to be your neighbour." So I just went down there and knocked on their door one day. So we had this new car that was donated to us, and the driver was unfamiliar with this car. It had all sorts of bells and whistles and alarms. You know, you can't put your seatbelt, you can't drive without putting your seatbelt on. If you get out of the car, well, it's in D for drive, and it's got a fob, but it hasn't got a key you pull out. These alarms go off. So we get there early, I'm on my way to a radio station talk. So we left 15 minutes early so I could introduce myself to these people and just kind of say hello.
7 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah. Yeah, 7:30 in the morning, yeah. We park outside their bedroom window. I get out of the car, knock on the door. He's fumbling around trying to turn this alarm off. That's right on their bedroom window. I'm going, please turn that alarm off, please turn it off, this is going really bad. And the fly screen's open, so I know they're home, they're asleep. I'm knocking on the door, and then I'm like, okay, Anna Garrick is Simon, can't turn the car alarm off, I'm out of here, let's get out of here. So I make a bolt for the car, and then the front door opens. We're not interested!
Yeah.
There's a weirdo in a brown bedcloth and another weird looking bloke in white, and so I turned around and said, oh look, I'm sorry mate, we're not here to sell anything, we might be your new neighbours, I just came to say hello. And in a slightly less irritated voice he grumbled and said, alright then, and he closed the door and allowed us to leave. So I'm in the process of writing an apology for that misfortunate incident, but it made for a good story at both of the prisons. The guys absolutely thought it was the funniest thing ever, but so I have to make amends with that older English couple. And I'll send the full story out on the emails, plus there'll be a video of the drone footage. It's absolutely fascinating. It's a beautiful spot, you know. You can actually, that the whales go past there with their calves. And there's 500 metres of bush between us and the beach or the cliffs, and then a little bit further along you've got Mutton Bird Beach. That is actually a beach, which would probably be an hour walk or that, something like that. So we don't have an access road, but because our supporters there are all in the know, so we even know the local mafia. This guy owns half of Albany, apparently. His name is Paul Leonetti. He's a very kind man. And Paul introduced us to the member for Albany, Peter Watson. And he has arranged a meeting for us, because what we found was the old English couple, next door to them is a strip of land called a gazetted road reserve, and it hasn't been developed, and if we develop that, and it can link into our property. So I had a chat with Peter Watson, and he's arranged with another member for Nollamara, which is Janine Freeman, a meeting with the Minister for Planning at Parliament House. And I just thought, how does this happen? People lobby the local council and government for 10 years to get a pathway out in the front of their house. And I go and see this mafia guy. And I'm in the Parliament House. I've got a meeting in Parliament House on the 7th to discuss this possibility of getting this road developed. So that's really wonderful. So I'm really happy about that. And we may be able to develop that road. The Buddhist Society of WA are prepared to contribute to the development of that road, because it would cost a bit of money, and that will get us in. Once we have the two road accesses, we can develop it, you know, like a small version of Bodhinyana Monastery, and that would be one.
Bigger.
It is bigger. It's 160 acres, but I don't want to put Ajahn Brahm's nose out of trouble, so I'm just going to keep it small. Actually, he's running the, he's pulling the levers and strings in the background anyway, so I'm just the kind of front man, monk, and he kind of helps raise all the funds and stuff. And he came down to Albany and checked out the property. I said, we can't go ahead and buy this without you at least coming down and putting his stamp of approval on it. So he did that. Came down, and last month and looked at another property because of this road access issue. And we looked at another property which was actually on the further around a place called Camp Quarana. It's quite remote. But Arjun didn't like it because it was too swampy, it was down low, whereas this property that we're looking at in Ellicott, it's on top of the hill. So it's ideal for a monastery. And it will be the same as Bonignana. You guys will be able to come and visit, stay there. Once we get a male guest quarters started, like Doug knows, he comes and stays at the Bonignana Monastery in Serpentine. People, meditators can just come and stay. You're down in Albany visiting friends, or come and stay at the monastery in Albany for a night or two, you know. So that's the idea. Yes.
Is this sort of a meditation retreat, like young growth?
It's all possible in the future. Yeah, that.
Because the Ajahn Brahm's 9-day retreat.
Yeah.
And some of the girls saying on Friday, Thursday, it's sold out in under 2 minutes.
Yes.
Yeah, 3 minutes. Yeah.
3 minutes.
If you haven't got a PayPal account, you won't have time to put your credit card number.
Correct. Yeah. That's right.
It's just Ajahn Brahm, also it's the same for us.
Yeah, yeah, these retreats are.
So there's obviously a need for it, and there's people coming from all over the world just to go to that.
Yeah.
It's quite amazing.
It is, yeah. Ajahn Brahm, he looked at the site because the lady who comes to the meditation in Albany, she's owns a property in front. Arjun was even said to her that was told me to say to her the BSW way would be interested in buying her whole property just so we could get an access road in there. And he said if we do that, that could be something like a retreat center because it's separate from the 160 acre property behind it. Her property is a 40 acre property in front, and it's completely separate. You could have your dining hall there where the dana's done, and a retreat center, and then have the monks up the back in their privacy, because it's like you can't get to it unless you go through this property, which would be wonderful. And we mentioned that to her, and you know, sooner or later when she decides she wants to sell, she might be interested in doing that. At the moment she's got two daughters and it's like a home base for them. So, you know, I felt bad. I said, please forgive me for pushing you on this. I'm going to leave you alone now. I still want you to come to the meditation group, you know, in Albany. So she still comes. But, it'll be a great centre. There's a lot of support down there, not only in Albany, but the support overseas. Ajahn Brahm's talking about it overseas, and people are getting on board all around the place. And it's we've even got, you'll see the logo on the front of that sheet. That took a little while to come up with that. A friend of mine had the idea of the whale in the background. There's a lot of whale cliche logos in Albany.
That's, I did a whale at the time in Albany.
That's right. But I think what we've done is quite unique. You've got the Buddha sitting in front of the whale tail, and it's a little bit like that image of the Buddha sitting in front of the serpent, the snake, or the cobra with the hood opened up, protecting the Buddha. This is similar to that. This is quite nice, and we've called it Bodhinyana. So it's a branch monastery of Bodhinyana Serpentine. Bodhinyana, Great Southern, not Albany. It's for the whole of Great Southern.
Yeah.
And we're stealing that word great because it makes it sound great. And that's I've done my sales pitch now on Albany, but it is exciting. I wanted to share it with you guys because I wanted to invite everyone down there that if you ever come down to Albany, it's a lovely place to live as well. My brother lives there, and it's kind of like a country town. It's old, for those of you who don't know. It was the first place to be settled in WA before Perth. It was about 2 years prior to Perth. It was also the place where the Anzacs set off from.
The last place they saw.
So it is an important place. Also, for those events. I think even the premier goes down there for that event quite often. It's really important. Yeah, my brother's wife, her brother's Navy boys, so it's big for them. I'd like to see how we could get involved with it somehow without it breaking our vineyard, because the vineyard says that the monks aren't allowed to attend military parades. That's how it's spelled out in our monastic rules of conduct. But you know, it's not exactly a parade where they march with their guns, but that does kind of happen too. So something I like to talk to Ajahn Brahm about. But before I finish, I have one of Ajahn Brahm's jokes he's given me that he's asked me to share with you guys. Alcohol and fats. It's a relief to know the truth after all those conflicting medical studies. The Japanese eat very little fat and suffer fewer heart attacks than the British and Americans. The French eat a lot of fat and also suffer fewer heart attacks than the British or Americans. The Japanese drink very little red wine and suffer fewer heart attacks than the British or Americans. The Italians drink excessive amounts of red wine and also suffer fewer heart attacks than the British or Americans. The Germans drink a lot of beer and eat a lot of sausages and fats and suffer fewer heart attacks than the British or Americans. Conclusion. Eat and drink what you like. Speaking English is apparently what kills you. You can blame Ajahn Brahm for that. Not me. Thank you for having me here this evening.